Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for pulling up to the speakers to listen to the program yet again. I sure appreciate it. My number is 888-914-9149. And as you regulars know, that number will work to get you on the air with your comment or question, but the call lines fill up quickly, so earlier in the hour is always better. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. We'll start off with E. Frank in New York. First up this morning. Good morning, E. Frank.
Yes, good morning, Patrick. I'm calling this morning because I have a question about what type of attire is appropriate during Holy Week in the church. I was told that not respecting the days of Holy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and Easter Sunday through attire is disrespectful towards the Lord and the church. And I'm a confirmed Catholic, but I never heard of that, and they told me that, and I don't know what you think about that. What was your take and your opinion in regards to attire during Holy Week?
All right. Well, I'll preface my remarks by saying this is just my own opinion. The church does not have a teaching or a custom per se, so you're not obligated to dress in a particular way. And it's always ideal, it seems to me, that people show up at all. So the fact that somebody comes to Mass, regardless of what he's wearing, within bounds of reason, of course, you don't want to be wearing something that would be immodest or offensive or anything like that. So we're not talking about that kind of extreme things. But if you're wearing your, you know, the clothes that you work in because you had time to get off work and come to Mass, that's fine. The church doesn't say that there's anything wrong with that, certainly not sinful. If you want to put on a suit and tie, or if you're a woman, you want to put on a dress and be more dressed up, that's fine too. But the church doesn't have a teaching or a custom per se that it must be a certain kind of attire. Also, there's nothing different about the Triduum, those 3 days at the end, after the end of Lent, leading up to Easter Sunday. There's nothing unique about those days by way of attire. So I think the general principle, as I understand it, is if you can, it's a good idea to be as presentable as possible because you're going to see Jesus. You're going to worship God in spirit and truth in the Mass. And so it's appropriate and it's a good thing to do to show respect for the Lord in that way. If you're not able to do that, or if you're too poor to do that. Some people, they don't have nice clothes. It's just how they are because they don't have a lot of money. The church does not frown upon that or say that they're doing anything wrong. So about as close as I can come to a do this would be, if you can show more respect for the Lord and if dressing in a finer way is a way of doing that, then do that. If you're unable to do that because of time or finances or some other reason, then do the best you can. I think that's the best way to look at it. Now, a word about the things that would be beyond the limits. I remember, E. Frank, one time I was at a parish in Southern California. I was there for Mass because I think I was going to be, maybe I was going to give a parish mission or something, and they wanted me to speak after the Masses on Sunday to announce this parish mission. And I was just flabbergasted and deeply offended by a man who was walking toward the church in front of me from the parking lot. And he had on shorts and flip-flops, but he had on a T-shirt that in big block letters had a colloquial phrase on it that involved a four-letter word. Big, you couldn't miss it, big block letters. And he was going into church. So personally, I don't think flip-flops and shorts is a good idea. I think if you have pants and shoes, you should wear those because that's a sign of respect. But even aside from that, the shirt was so offensive and so egregious that I felt I had no choice, but I went over to one of the ushers and I said, you need to go tell that guy, change his shirt, take it off or whatever, but he shouldn't be in mass where people are going to be seeing that. It's deeply offensive. And the usher went over to him and talked to him, and I didn't see what happened after that. So obviously something that's offensive or blasphemous or very immodest, you know, use your imagination, or maybe don't use your imagination. Those kinds of things obviously have no place in church. But if it's just your work clothes or the best you can do, the church is just happy that you're there at Mass at all. That's how I would answer that question. E. Frank, any thoughts from you?
Yeah, I agree with you totally. I also agree that you must be presentable according to your proper understanding and knowledge, and not according to someone else's opinion. But I also believe that when I was an altar boy, you know, they usually told me to wear a cassock or a hooded monk type of outfit. And I actually did what I was told. I always agreed. And I, when I was in parochial school, I had to uphold the dress code all the time. But, you know, sometimes it was always difficult for when you're attending Mass on a regular basis, what type of presentability you can contain in at the Mass. So if there's a special event, we understand a Knight of Columbus or whatever type of a wedding, we know what type of attire. But then, you know, for years and years in my church, people or the parishioners used to wear different themes. They stopped. We had an anniversary recently, and they stopped doing that, and they now uphold some sort of strange biblical dress code that indicates that they cannot have any type of insignias or emblems or anything that might indicate what they're feeling at that point in time, like a sports team or anything of that nature. So,
right. I agree with that, and I'll just jump in to say I think a lot of this is the same reason why Catholic schools and other parochial schools, or even just private schools in general, for younger grades have a dress code. And it's the same. I think human psychology comes into play here. If everybody is customizing what they're wearing, and you mentioned sports teams, jerseys, and things like that, where does it end? And so one way to keep uniformity, literally, is to have the kids wear uniforms. That way, nobody is sporting emblems. Nobody is promoting something that would be considered in poor taste. Everybody wears the same thing. It's like in the military. You go in the military, you're going to wear the same clothes that everybody else wears in your group, because that's part of the cohesion. And that's a good thing in schools as well. Well, E. Frank, I think I've exhausted my offering for you on this topic. I do appreciate the phone call, though. Great way to get the day started today. Thanks for the call. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I have an email that I want to read to you. Now, this is on a marriage question, and so it's not going to be suitable for sure for younger people. And parents, please exercise caution, exercise good judgment. And if you have kids, let's say, below the age of high school, or even maybe younger grades in high school, this probably is not for them. So turn the radio down for a few minutes or send them elsewhere. So please take that seriously. Fair warning, ready, steady, go. This is an email, and I'm going to leave her name anonymous. She does give her name in her email, but it's sensitive enough that we'll just leave her anonymous. So she says, I love your show. I listen on the app. And she's listening and writing in from Ontario, Canada. She says, my husband and I are both Catholic. This will be a problem that is probably not unusual for many people. This is my editorial comment. She says, my husband has had a problem with pornography since long before we were married and during our marriage, during that time, I was not aware of it. We were unable to conceive, and she mentioned a couple of the physiological reasons for that. They're just like genetic problems. And she says, although she did have a couple of miscarriages, then eventually they sought help. She says, through our doctor, we were referred to a fertility clinic. And against the church's teachings, we paid for 8 rounds of IUI, which is intrauterine insemination, though without success. I developed uterine cancer, she says, and had to have a complete hysterectomy. Shortly after my surgery, The marital act became very painful. I have tried medications to prevent the pain, but to no avail. My husband, here's where this becomes extra not appropriate for children, okay? One last chance, parents, exercise caution here. Turn the radio down, please. My husband turned to prostitutes behind my back and spent over $30,000 over 2 years. When all of this came to light, I was filled with rage. I went through a time of blaming myself because I wasn't, quote unquote, available for him. We went for counseling and retrovi. Although I struggled, but with God's grace, I made the choice to forgive him and told him that I cannot guarantee that intimacy will ever be resumed. He still wanted to stay and work on restoring our marriage. Even though we have reconciled, a part of me still feels nauseous when I think that I must have marital relations with him because I know some of the horrible things that he did with so many women, and then all the men that those women have been with. He was tested for HIV and other diseases, and they came back negative. In confession, I explained my situation to the priest, and he counseled that if the act is painful, then I am not committing a sin by refusing my husband's advances. What are your thoughts on this? As I do not want to live in sin, and I also do not want to be responsible for leading my husband into mortal sin. Thanks for taking time to read this. I have learned so much from your show. God bless you. Well, thank you. First of all, my heart sincerely goes out to you for having had to deal with this insanity in your marriage for so long. I'm just so sorry to hear this, and I'm amazed, quite frankly, at your resilience and your tenacity in your marriage. Many people would not be as resilient and as tenacious as you have been, so I want to praise you and compliment you for having that, as my grandmother used to call it, the stick-to-itiveness that you have. So let's take them in order. You mentioned the hysterectomy, which has resulted in pain. Well, this is one of those realities physiologically for some people, and the church understands that. And although, yes, there is what's known as the marriage debt, and both the husband and the wife are called contract of marriage, in which they freely consent to mutual self-giving, which includes their bodies. It's not an absolute and unrestricted right over your spouse's body, his over yours or yours over his. And this would be an example of where something comes into play that now makes it, you're not liable. Certainly it's not sinful if because you can't, you don't. And pain is pain, and if it's painful, it becomes a terrible thing if it's just one of the two receiving the pleasure and the other one is experiencing a great deal of pain. That's not good. The old saying is true. If it's good for you and it's good for me, it's good. If it's not good for you or it's not good for me, it's not good. I think that maxim applies in this case. So in terms of sin, because you asked about sin and you mentioned going to confession, if you're unable to have this kind of intimacy, you're not committing a sin because you're not able to do it. And God does not expect the impossible. The same would be true, or at least it's a similar kind of thing, after childbirth. The husband can't just demand this from his wife because she needs to recuperate. Now, different people hold different views on that, but the general rule of thumb that I have always heard is about 6 weeks, and maybe more, depending upon the woman and the delivery. And for those 6 weeks, the husband, he doesn't have the right to request something that is going to be difficult or painful for his wife. He just doesn't have that right. So the reason I'm saying this is to give you some examples of how there are situations in which the husband and the wife should not ask for this because it's not due to them under these circumstances. And the one that you're experiencing with the pain after the operation is an example of that. So please don't ever feel guilty about that because your heart is in the right place, obviously, and you would like to do everything you can to the extent that you are able to do so, but this is preventing you. So I wouldn't give that any further thought personally as far as sin is concerned. Now, the second part, the much, much worse part, is his betrayal of you in the marriage in just a gross and long-standing way. The spending of the money, the craziness with these prostitutes, and everything else that goes into that. I don't even want to imagine it. The thing to remember is you are not committing a sin if you said, no, sorry, we're not doing that anymore, because he has forfeited his right to that. That's the key to this part of the question. The wife is not obliged. Now, she can, and some wives do, forgive and say, all right, well, let's work on our marriage, and you can come back, and we'll live together as we did before. I think that's an example of heroic virtue on the part of the wife or the husband. I've seen it happen the other direction as well, where the wife was running around, and then the husband, in his magnanimity, took her back. I've seen that a few times, but I'm guessing probably more common, again, guessing, that it's more common that the wife would do this. But in any case, regardless of the ratios, it doesn't really matter. The fact is, and the church will tell you that if this happens in your marriage, he has effectively forfeited his right to live with you as man and wife. And you have the right to say no forever until death do us part, or maybe I'll change my mind later, or you're in the driver's seat when it comes to this issue. And you're certainly not committing a sin if you say, I'm just grossed out, I feel nauseous, I can't believe everything that's happened, and the very thought of this just sickens me. If you say no, he's earned that no over and over and over again, obviously. So I'll leave it at that. You're not living in sin. It seems to me you're practicing heroic virtue by doing as much as you have done. Et cetera, et cetera. I feel as though maybe at this point I would be repeating myself. So if I can just offer you that word of encouragement, naturally, if your conscience is bothering you, as you did, bring it to confession. And I have a feeling that what the priest told you in longer form is the same thing as what I'm saying. You're not committing a sin. He has lost his right to this. You have the right, if you wish, to change your mind at some point and see where things go. But in the meantime, the church would say, you're not doing anything wrong. All right. Well, I hope that's helpful to you. I hope that gives you a little bit more encouragement. I'm so sorry to hear that this situation is taking place. But, you know, what does Jesus say? Jesus says, with man, this is impossible. But for God, all things are possible, including the restoration of marriages that have been just destroyed in ways like this. So hang in there. We'll pray for you. And I hope things do get better. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show, including your phone calls right after this. Here's the number, 888-914-9149. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
888-914-9149. You can use that number right now. Amazingly, we've got some lines open. It won't last too long, though. 888-914-9149. In the meantime, though, I've got some emails I want to share with you, some that have come in recent days. This one comes in from Veronica. Now, she doesn't ask me to keep her name anonymous, so I'm good. I think I can say where she's listening in California. And this way, Veronica, you'll know that I'm reading your email. So she says, I accidentally found your radio show through the grace of God and my holy angels. The reason for my email is my paternal uncle passed away last year on Christmas because of COVID, and his wife passed away last year on New Year's Day due to COVID. Prior to their deaths, they left the Catholic Church and became Protestants. When my aunt and uncle passed away, I kept praying for them. I'd offer up the Holy Mass, my family, and I would pray the rosary, and I'd offer that up for them. I'd pray for them on my own. One night, she says, I had a dream, and I saw my uncle very clearly, and he asked me to stop praying for him. When I woke up, I was confused. Should I pray for him or not? I automatically assumed that he went to hell. Prior to my dream, I had no second thought. It just came to me naturally, And after my dream, I couldn't concentrate when I would try to pray for him. I couldn't stop thinking about the dream, or better said, my nightmare. I thought the Bible verse, Ecclesiasticus 34, verses 1 and 2, where it says, "Vain and deceptive hopes are for the foolish, and dreams lend wings to fools, as well as clutch at shadows and chase the wind, but put to put faith." I'm sorry, as well clutch at shadows, but let me just rephrase it, just as well to clutch at shadows and chase the wind as to put any faith in dreams. So Veronica says, "I thought of all the people who had dreams in the Bible, also Joseph, the dreamer in Pharaoh's court, and Joseph the carpenter, foster father of Jesus." She says, "I was very confused about the nightmare. Could it be real or could it be fake? I didn't know which Bible verse could be for me. I really don't know what question to ask other than that I'm confused, and I don't know, should I start praying for my uncle again? I did stop praying for him. Do you believe the nightmare was from above or from the evil one? Why would my uncle want me to stop praying for him? If I didn't ask the right question, maybe you can advise me in the right direction." And I'm happy to give you some thoughts on this, Veronica, and I could see why it would be bothersome to you. You love your aunt and uncle, and you want them to be happy in heaven. And it's good that you should pray for them in any case. So let's take a look at the dreams, or the dream. Well, it is true that God speaks to his people sometimes through dreams. And sometimes he will use an angel, like in the case of St. Joseph, when he was warned by an angel in a dream, "Get up, take Mary and baby Jesus, and get out of here right away because Herod wants to come and kill baby Jesus." So he did. He got up. He saw God's plan for him in the dream, and he got up and he acted upon it. And you're mentioning the dreams and the interpretation of dreams, rather, by Joseph in Egypt in the Old Testament, and that certainly is valid too. So the fact that a dream in itself has a message for you is not, in my view at least, is not something that you could automatically say, well, that's just my imagination, or that's just God. I don't think it's safe to say with certitude it's definitely one or the other. I would say leave open the possibility in your own mind that this could have been from God, and I'll explain to you what I mean by that in a moment, but most likely isn't. So if I had to guess, my guess is that it may not have anything to do with the supernatural realm. It may just simply be the inner workings of your own subconscious and your own internal thoughts and hopes and desires. And you know how when you have a dream, all kinds of things come out in your dreams that seem to make sense during the dream, but when you wake up and you're trying to remember what you can of that dream, it suddenly doesn't really make a lot of sense at all. But in the dream, it makes a lot of sense. And as I understand it, our dreams are part of our soul's way of kind of processing through our bodily organs, through the brain, which interacts with the soul in a bodily sense. And it's a way of processing things and moving things through. It's almost like the kidneys of the mind, you know, where you take out all the things that are there and you purify or you do different things with them. I've often wondered if dreams are kind of like that. You know, maybe the bodies and the soul system working together to purify things. I don't know. So I think if I had to guess, it's most likely coming from your imagination. And I don't mean to say that in a condescending way. What I mean is that's natural. Our dreams are the manifestations of the things going on in our minds and things we're processing without even necessarily really realizing it. And it could be that in your grief and you're missing your family members, that it came out in this dream. So let's put that on the table as one possibility. Another possibility is that this is because he's now in heaven and your prayers helped him. Now you mentioned that he left the Catholic Church and became a Protestant. So right there, that puts a big question mark as to where somebody would go, for the reason that if somebody abandons the church, walks away from the church, that's a serious sin, and who knows what may have happened between the time that they died and maybe even just a few seconds before they died. I know they died separately, but maybe there was a repentance, and maybe there was a desire to, at least in his heart, return to the church. It's possible. So we can always hold out hope that they were saved. But it seems like the likelihood of that goes down, maybe way down, all of the things being equal. Only God knows for sure. So it's possible that if this is the happy ending and he wound up getting to heaven, then it's possible that by God's permission, he was allowed to say to you, you don't need to pray for me anymore. I think that's very unlikely. Another possibility is that he was, and I want to say this gently, but it is another real possibility, and that is that in some cases, God will permit the souls of the damned, and I'm not saying that he was damned. I don't know. There's no way for any of us to know unless God reveals it. But there have been many instances in the life of the church, say the lives of the saints and others, in which God has permitted a soul who has died and gone to hell to manifest to somebody in this life to say, as a warning, I am now in hell. So we have documented historical examples of this happening. I don't know if what you described is that, but that's another possibility. And when that happens, that's in all the cases that I've read about, it's by way of warning. So God is permitting this soul to warn people in this life. Kind of like how Lazarus, when he went to be with Abraham when he died, and the rich man went to be in the place of fiery torment, also in the underworld when he died, and he asked Abraham, please send Lazarus to my brothers who are still alive and warn them so that they won't come to this place of punishment. And he gets a negative answer. Abraham says, nope. Not only can we not cross to where you are, you can't cross to where we are, but your brothers have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. And if they don't listen to them, they had their chance, kind of thing. So there's an example where you see a negative answer to that request, and that's in Luke 16, by the way. But there are instances where God will permit this for the benefit of those who are still alive. So those are the things that come to my mind, and to kind of consolidate all of those thoughts, I would say it seems to me that it's more likely than not that it's just something from your imagination. So I wouldn't worry about it. I would continue to pray for your aunt and uncle. Now, if you have another dream, or if you have some other kind of vivid manifestation of the same message, take that into account. And remember, too, as a little footnote to all of this, naturally, if your uncle is in purgatory and in need of your prayers, because in heaven they don't need your prayers, and in hell they can't benefit from them. So if he's in purgatory and he wants and he needs your prayers there, just think about the devil connection here for a minute. The devil certainly doesn't want you to pray, and he will try to discourage you from praying. But what's weird about this scenario is if your uncle were in purgatory, and if it was the devil who was trying to dissuade you from praying, it doesn't really do him any good, because your uncle is lost to him. There's nothing he can do to snatch your uncle away if he died in the state of grace. So it's kind of beside the point. I mean, like, the devil wants to work on people that he has some kind of chance of getting. And if your husband, I keep saying your husband, I apologize for that. If your uncle is in purgatory, he's beyond his reach. And there's nothing he can ever do that would undo that. So it seems to me that it's probably less likely that it's a devil trying to tell you, don't pray for him, because even if it slows down the process of him being in purgatory, the net effect is the same. He's going to go to heaven regardless. So although it could be a diabolical voice, I tend to think it's probably not. So anyway, there you have it. Those are my thoughts. I'm glad you wrote to me. And by the way, anybody who wants to write in, just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. You can read that, or you just click on connect, and you can read right there where you can send me an email. Here's a note that comes in from Mark, who is listening in California, in Los Angeles to be exact. He says, Patrick, I have a friend whose child is going to Notre Dame University to play a sport. They have never had God in their lives. He asked me, what is Catholic all about? And unfortunately, it stumped me a little bit. I did tell him all the things I do and some of the things I know. He asked me if there was a good book. Your book, Why Be Catholic, came to mind. But it seems like a book for someone who has a small or some foundation of God and Christianity. Would you recommend a book, or is there another I should tell him about? I love your show. Thank you. Well, thank you for that, Mark. I think that Why Be Catholic would be a reasonable book to give him, because although it does kind of presuppose a few things, like that the person believes in God, it kind of gets down to the bedrock of why, if you believe in God, why would you believe that Jesus is God? Why would you believe that he established a church? And how can you tell what the church is? How can you find it? So a lot of the preliminaries are in the early part of the book, Why Be Catholic? And if he has some belief in God, even though he's never, you know, been religious, that would be a book that you could start with. Okay. But there are plenty of other ones. I recommend a book by Dr. Peter Kraft. I love his books in general, but this one is called The Philosophy of Jesus. The Philosophy of Jesus. And I recall one time, Mark, I was on an airplane. I don't know where I was going, but I was seated next to an airline pilot who was, I guess, commuting back home. So he was seated next to me, and we started talking, as people do. And little by little, it sort of came out. He asked me what I did, because he said he was a pilot. And so we talked about aviation, because I love all that stuff. And he says, well, what do you do? And I said, oh, well, I'm an author and a radio host. And he says, really? Well, what do you talk about? That's the inevitable question. What do you talk about on the radio? Or what kind of books do you write? So I said, oh, I write books about God and faith and history and things like that. And he says, oh, are you Christian? I said, yeah, I'm Catholic. The original Christianity. And he said, oh, well, as long as I've got you here, I have never understood what you guys mean by the Trinity. I mean, I hear you talk about the Trinity. I know you believe in God. He says, and I've got some Christian friends, airline pilots and others I've talked to, and I can never get a straight answer out of them. I can never figure out what do they mean when they say they believe in one God, but three persons in one God, because you believe Jesus is God, et cetera. And I said, that's a great question. So I explained it to him as best I could over the next 45 minutes or so. But I just happened to have a copy of this book in my briefcase, The Philosophy of Jesus. And I had been reading it, and I had been enjoying it. And I thought this would be a good book to give to this airline pilot. It was a hardcover edition. So I thought, do I want to give this away? And then I thought, what have I got to lose? It's like scattering the seed, you know, and you don't know what kind of soil it's going to fall on. So I said, I just happen to have this book that will kind of lay out for you the philosophy of Jesus. And he does talk about, although the Trinity is not front and center in that book, he does talk about the teachings of Jesus with regard to God. So this Jewish airline pilot was really interested. He's like, I really appreciate that. Thank you. So I signed it for him, gave it to him, and I've never heard from him again. He didn't email me. There's no like magically happy ending that took place. I'll never know until I find out. Maybe in heaven we'll talk to each other if he's there. But in the meantime, that was a book that I thought would be helpful to him, because he had no foundation at all other than knowing about God. And I don't think he was a practicing Jew. I think he was a secular Jew. So that might be a kind of parallel. So try that book. The Philosophy of Jesus. And there are many other great books by Dr. Peter Kraft, K-R-E-E-F-T, if you want to look them up. I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you for that. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back with more of this program. And that can include your phone call if you call this number, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Call that number. We'll get you on the air with your comment or question, and I'll be right back. This hour sponsored by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union, where you can boost your savings with their 14-month share certificate, earning a 4.14% annual percentage yield. Info at relevantradio.com/certificate.
Real life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good stuff by the B-52s, that's for sure. 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. This is pretty cool. Robert sent me an email a couple of minutes ago. He's listening in Madison, Wisconsin, and he's responding to the call that I took at the top of the hour this hour about, the caller asked, is there some like special church custom or something about the kind of attire you should wear during Holy Week leading up to Easter, and I said no. And so Robert says in his email, "Dear Patrick, I appreciate your talk with the caller. It did remind me that we should be glad that we are at church, but if I may ask for a small favor, I routinely see a man wearing sports jerseys at Mass, so can you tell me to mind my own business and not be distracted?" As you wish, Robert, happy to do so. I don't want to be so blunt, but if that will help you, sure, mind your own business and don't be distracted. And I know it's easier said than done. And quite frankly, as long as we're on the topic, I do agree with you, Robert, that, and I'm just going to put this out there, don't wear sports jerseys to Mass. You may say, well, how come? Well, because first of all, you're not there to root for your team. You're there to worship God. You're there to fellowship with your fellow Catholics, but primarily to worship God in spirit and in truth. Think about this for a second, Mr. Sports Jersey Wearing Guy. It sounds like a beer commercial, doesn't it? I'm not talking to you, Robert, obviously. I know you wouldn't do that. So I'm just going to put this out there. Remember, when you go to Mass, you are being made present by God's power. You're being made present at the Last Supper in a mystical way. You are simultaneously being made present at Calvary. Imagine yourself standing at the foot of the cross with Our Lady and St. John and St. Mary Magdalene and the other holy women and all that that's going on, and you are made present there when you're at Mass. And you're also in the Holy of Holies in the heavenly sanctuary, where the Lord, as the high priest and perfect victim, he's offering himself to the Father eternally on our behalf. And though the hosts in heaven are singing, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God of hosts," all of that's going on in heaven. And when you are at Mass, you're being made present at all three of these realities all at once. You don't see it with your physical eyes, obviously, but that's the reality of what you're participating in and what you're made present at. Do you really think it would be a good idea to wear a football or a baseball team jersey standing at the foot of the cross? Would that seem a bit jarring, maybe? And some smart aleck will say, well, just as if they come to the foot of the cross, it doesn't matter what they're wearing. People can wear whatever. Yeah, that's true, but you get what I'm saying. The whole idea of showing respect. So I think it's a valid thing for people to at least think about. When you're getting ready for Mass, are you just stopping the family backyard barbecue long enough to get to Mass to fulfill your Sunday obligation? Then you're going to get back to the beer and frisbee and all that. Or, I mean, are you putting your mind and your heart into it and you're thinking, I'm going to see the Lord? Now, you don't have to wear any particular kind of clothing, but just in a human sense, don't you think it makes sense to try to be more presentable? If you were going to have, I don't know, if you're going to go to the Oscars, would you show up in your work clothes or would you go rent a tux or at least put on a suit? If you were invited to go to the Vatican and meet with the Pope, would you just, you know, put on your flip-flops and keep your beard, your sports jersey and shorts and go see the Pope? Probably not. And if you did, they'd probably tell you, you know what? You can't come in here and meet the Pope just like that. So take an hour, go find a store, get some real clothes, and then come back. Because it's disrespectful. So I'll leave it at that. Don't want to harp. But you have that, you have my, what's the word I'm looking for, Robert? You have my agreement on this issue with you. I feel like you do on this issue. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Rose in Pittsburgh. Hi, Rose. How are you?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Patrick. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Okay.
What's on your mind?
I went to confession this past weekend after 7 years, and it was a good experience. So I'm encouraging people, if it's something has been on their heart or their mind, to go into confession. But during my confession, thank you. I have a question. How does the priest discern the penance during confession? So I spoke what was on my heart, and he said that I should go say one Our Father, which I was like, okay, I can do this. I
After
wonder how
7
he discerns
years?
That. And yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it was a specific situation that I bring up, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I want to know, is it okay to add extra prayers in addition to the penance prayers that I did? Because I added a Hail Mary on my own, and I added a Glory Be, and I did another Our Father, and I went and I lit a candle, and I just kind of, I was feeling God at that moment.
That's beautiful. Well, I'm happy to hear that. That's really great. To answer your first, really the essence of your question is, how do they determine what penance to give? In the final year of seminary formation, so this would be when the man, typically, would be when the man has been ordained a transitional deacon, and he's going through the final phases of preparing to be a priest and to celebrate the sacraments. And they have a practicum in which they, typically it would be something like this. There would be a practicum that you would study in the class on the sacraments, and you would not only study how to confer the sacrament and the theology and the biblical basis for it, but you would also practice how to do it. So they practice how to celebrate Mass. They practice how to hear confessions. In fact, in some circumstances, there would even be a panel maybe of a few priests who would be there to ask them questions, like the kind of questions you might hear in a confessional. And so they would ask the seminary student, okay, here's a sin that was just confessed to you by a 32-year-old married mother of three children, and here's the sin that she just confessed. What is your advice? So they have a practicum that involves examples of what would be considered customary by way of a penance. So this, the reason I asked you, because you mentioned 7 years, and maybe you are a very extremely virtuous person who never commits any sin, much less serious sin, but most people couldn't go 7 years and not commit a serious sin if they're staying away from the sacraments. So what's surprising is that he would give you such a mild penance. Now, it would be appropriate if you really had no serious sins to speak of and maybe only some venial sins. But if there were some serious sins, typically you're going to have more of a penance because of the gravity, the greater gravity of the sins. So don't worry, Rose. I'm not asking you to say anything about your confession. I'm just saying, as a general principle, the more serious the sins and the more of them there are, the more of a penance is usually given. So it wouldn't be uncommon for a priest to say 10 Our Fathers and to say 10 Hail Marys, or say the Rosary, or make the Stations of the Cross. So he has the discretion of determining what penance he imposes upon you. But generally, as I say, the more weighty the sins are and the more of them, the more penance there is for that reason. So it's really kind of up to the priest. Now, it's possible that the priest is in the habit of giving extremely light penances because in his mind he might be concerned that if I give a heavy penance, it would scare the person away and she'll never come back. And I don't think that's likely to happen. But that could be a thought in his mind. So to your second question, there's nothing wrong whatsoever with adding more prayers. And if you feel, as I have felt at times in my own life, that really wasn't much of a penance. So you can certainly cheerfully do more as a way of showing your love for God and as a way of doing penance for the effects of your sins. That's a good thing. So you never have to worry or wonder if you are adding more to it. More is better, as they say.
Great, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate your show, and God bless you.
Thank you, Rose, and I'm so happy for you. 7 years is a long time. And
I wondered, too, when he didn't rush me, and I was surprised because it was 11 a.m. Saturday, and there was a line of people, which kind of, I was surprised, to be honest with you, and I had to wait a good 15, 20 minutes. Mm. And nobody was taking really, really long, and I think he was a retired priest, because I've seen him before, but I think he's a retired priest that helps out a certain parish here.
Okay.
And he didn't rush me at all during the confession. And I wonder if he just maybe discerns the tone of my voice or really the sadness that I was feeling or the mm-hmm. fact that I really, you know, thought I was doing something right in my life at the time and realized that it wasn't right with God. And I wonder if that went into his discernment. And then him being a retired priest, I'm sure he's heard a lot and seen a lot.
I'm sure he has. I'm sure he has. Any priest will tell you Any major dude will tell you, that's just a joke there, but any priest will tell you that after not too much time goes by, you start hearing the same sets of sins over and over again without a whole lot of variation. Every so often, there might be something off the beaten path, but for the most part, it's the same kinds of sins that most people fall into. And I don't know, in a way, it kind of gives a bit of comfort when you realize that there's no reason to stay away from confession out of fear. Not that you had this fear, Russ. I'm not saying you did, but some people do. They're just afraid, like, oh, I'm just going to shock the priest to death if he hears what I did. And he'll never, oh my gosh, I can't even admit to him that I did this. He's heard it a million times before. He's probably heard it from some of the people who were ahead of you in line in confession that very day, is what I hear from priests. So I think it gives penitents like us a sense of relief that you're not going to stick out like a sore thumb. It's pretty consistent from what I understand.
Yeah, and I just encourage people, go. It's Lent, and he even mentioned that, you know, he gave me my penance, and he said, stay close to Jesus during, you know, focus on the Eucharist, focus on these last few weeks of Lent. And I just think there's a lot of spiritual strength right now because of the Lent. And I encourage people, if it's on your heart, get over it, get over the pride, swallow it, Google the church, go to maybe one across town if you feel uncomfortable with your priest or your parish. And it felt good. It did.
I imagine it did. And what a beautiful way to encourage other people, Rose. I know there are people listening right now for whom they've been away from confession for a lot longer than 7 years. So it's a great incentive for people to do what that priest suggested to you. I'm really glad you did that. I'm glad you called today, too.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Have a good day. God bless you.
Yeah, you too. Take care. I have a note that came in a short while ago from John listening on the Relevant Radio app, and he's talking about a call from yesterday, a call with Michael. He says, I was listening to Michael's call yesterday, and I heard him say he didn't have anything to say to his sister about going to confession versus confessing to God directly. I find it hard to believe in this day and age that he doesn't know about any of the resources out there, especially Catholic Answers, or that he could just Google why confess to a priest and discover Catholic information in regards to that, especially if he's been listening to Relevant Radio. I hear you, John, I do, but it could be that maybe he's new to Relevant Radio, and so this is all new to him. And I don't fault him, because one thing I know for sure is that a lot of Catholics, and I'm a cradle Catholic, by the way, I'm not a convert, so I just know how easily Catholics wind up getting put on the defensive. And a lot of it has to do, quite frankly, with not studying the faith, not reading the Bible, at least not enough to be familiar with questions like this that come up. And so to recap for people who maybe didn't hear that call yesterday, he was saying that his sister told him, well, I don't need to go to confession anymore. She's a fallen away Catholic. I just confess directly to God. And he said he didn't know how to defend against that. And I said, well, you don't need to defend against that, at least part of it anyway, because for every Catholic listening right now, don't forget that in order for you to even be prepared to go to the sacrament of confession, you first have to go to God directly. You must confess your sins directly to God. And maybe that was a surprise to him, because there are people who hold this misunderstanding that Catholics go to the priest instead of God, or the Catholics don't think they can approach God directly, so they go to Mary instead of God, or they go to the priest instead of God. And they'll quote to you 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 5, for there is one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. And if you as a Catholic don't know your faith, and if you're not at least basically familiar with Scripture, if somebody quotes that to you and says, well, there's one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus, therefore you shouldn't go to a priest for confession, it not only shows that they don't understand the meaning of the passage, but if you're surprised by that and it shocks you, then you don't understand that either. So you don't want to be in that situation. So I understand, John. Thankfully, we live in an era where there is a plethora of good information about the Catholic faith. And Relevant Radio, I must say, at the top of the heap, if you ask me. I'll be right back right after this.